It's time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cyclists, trails, travel, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. You can subscribe to our weekly podcast at OutspokenCyclist.com or through your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our first show for October, October 2nd, 2021. This week, we have three conversations for you, and I hope you enjoy them all. Sea Otter 2020 was, of course, virtual only, so when Sea Otter director Frank Yohannan decided on an in-person event, we decided we needed to talk. The Sea Otter Classic is now over 30 years old and one of the most exciting events on the cycling calendar. It's usually held in April, but this year's festival was postponed until October, kicking off next Friday, October 7th. Frank will be with me in a moment to tell us all about it. So I purposely held back one of the next two conversations, as it is uniquely juxtaposed to the other. Dr. Marlon Lee Moncrief is a professor of education at the University of Brighton in the UK. Marlon is a cyclist, used to race his bicycle, and Marlon is black. During his time racing and since, he has asked the same questions as we do. Why aren't there more black cyclists in the pro peloton? And even more pertinent, where are all the black cyclists anywhere and everywhere? As such, Marlon's work has been centered around black cyclists, and his new book, Black Champions in Cycling, is a fascinating look into some of the places you might not be comfortable looking: discrimination, prejudice, and the abominable treatment of young athletes. And yet, there is desire and determination, and ultimately, there are successes. The book, the topic, and the author are all fascinating and enlightening. Then we bring USA Cycling's Rob DeMartini back to the show to unpack the first in the Inclusion Conference series. It's a raw look at what cycling needs to do to change the status quo and welcome everyone into the sport. Frank Yohannan is the director of the Sea Otter Classic, a festival of cycling that truly offers something for everyone. Although the expo will be smaller this year than in the past because of travel restrictions for overseas exhibitors, there will be no lack of fun or interesting things to do and see. Hi, Frank. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Sea Otter is, we're like T-minus 1 week. How are you and what's going on?
Well, thanks for having me, Diane. And I'm doing fine and excited to share with everybody that Sea Otter is rapidly in preparation to get everything all squared away for next week. So we're busy, but looking good.
Yeah, I think it is looking good. I'm hearing a lot of buzz about it. That's pretty exciting. So it's been a while since the last Sea Otter. What's transpired between now and then we'll try to catch up with what's actually going to happen this season?
Well, it's been 2.5 years since the last Sea Otter Classic. In April of 2019. We did have a virtual event in 2020, and normally Sea Otter goes in April, and of course, with the October event, that pushes out another 6 months. So, but we've been very busy with, getting ready for whenever we could host a Sea Otter Classic. So the 2.5 years have been full. With the virtual event and then also working with our international partners.
You did just have an international Sea Otter, a European Sea Otter, and you had an enormous number of people show up. How did that go, both physically in terms of people showing up and with sponsors and events?
Yeah, I spoke with the individuals that conduct the event in Girona, Spain, and they were very, very pleased with the event. It's also been a couple of years for them since they had Sea Otter Europe. The spectator numbers are very good. They were over 50,000 people attended and showed up. All of the athletic events went off very well. Good reports from the athletes. There were some companies that could not attend because of travel restrictions that their corporations had and so forth. So the expo for Sea Otter Europe was down a little bit, but the attendance numbers were way up. So they were very pleased, and they're already starting to plan for Sea Otter Europe next September 2022 also. In fact, they have a World Cup event in Girona this weekend. So things are ramping up in Europe.
I guess. Well, that brings some questions up for me for Sea Otter here, Monterey, next weekend. I know there are a lot of people already registered, and I'm wondering how the sponsors are feeling and whether you have some new sponsors this year and some new exhibitors and how the athletes are responding.
Well, the sponsors just continue to be very, very supportive. We are an international event, and like a lot of events, we're this year, there are some constraints due to COVID. So some of our partners are not able to attend, the Europeans again, the Asians, certainly nobody from Australia. So we will have a smaller expo at Sea Otter than we traditionally have. But I will say all of the exhibitors that cannot make it next week to Monterey have all said, put us on the list, keep our reservation, we'll be there in April of 2022. So it's not that they don't want to come, it's that they can't come because of COVID travel restrictions. Our athlete numbers are tracking almost exactly where we were, and actually a little bit better than we were in 2019. So those numbers are looking very good. Camping is sold out. I can tell you that the local hotels and motels are really excited because they're seeing good reservation numbers. Restaurants, I tried to get some reservations the other day at a restaurant for next week during Sea Otter, and they said, no, sorry, Sea Otter's here, we're booked up.
So not knowing that you are Sea Otter.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was good news to me, but I'll have to find someplace else to, to go, of course. So all the numbers other than numbers impacted by travel, COVID travel restrictions, are looking really good. And the final thing on that is that we've had a number of local outdoor festivals, Rodeo, Monterey Jazz Festival, and so forth. Their numbers have been much higher than what they had anticipated with walk up at the gate. So I think we're going to see the same at Sea Otter.
Let me remind listeners, we're speaking with Frank Yohannan. He is the founder of Sea Otter. You're still the president of Sea Otter, if I'm not mistaken.
I am the director of Sea Otter Classic. And now is probably a really good time to,
note that
Sea Otter Classic is now owned by a wonderful company called Lifetime. And Lifetime acquired Sea Otter a couple of months ago. And your listeners would know them as being a very upscale company that, provides health facilities across the country. But beyond that, they host many, many events across the United States. I think it's over 35 events now, everything from the Miami Marathon, the Chicago Half Marathon, New York Triathlon, Leadville Series, and so forth. So Sea Otter is part of that portfolio. And this will be the first Lifetime Sea Otter Classic. And we're really excited to partner with them. And I will continue with Lifetime for 3 years. And all of the key leadership staff that I've had with me for 10, 15 years have all moved over, and they're going to stay with the event also.
So do you see any future changes that Lifetime wants to make? I understand. So, Outside is doing it on the media side. Lifetime seems to be doing it on the event side. And I see good and maybe not so good always with consolidation. But this one sounds like it's a good thing.
I think it's a very good thing. I look at it from a business standpoint. That's been really my role, my responsibility for a number of years now. And Lifetime brings a very strong depth of talent and knowledge in event business, and certainly outdoor events like mountain biking and triathlons and marathons and so forth. And I see the future as being terrific. They like what they see at Sea Otter. They want to improve it, make changes where it's necessary, and bring the resources in to make that happen. And the resources being the right people and the right financing if that's necessary.
Do you, and this is one of those pie in the sky kind of things for somebody who lives east of the Mississippi, do you see that perhaps Lifetime might take a version of Sea Otter East?
I don't know. I really, that's something that I have not discussed with them. I think that really as a very professional organization, I suspect what they're going to do first is just take a look at what they have, how Sea Otter does coming out of COVID and the pandemic. We're very quickly going to roll into April 2022 Sea Otter Classic. So I think the long-term strategic look at you know, what's going to happen with regard to Sea Otter and Sea Otter type events, that won't occur until after next April's event. And there may be no change. Yeah, there may be no change, Diane.
Sure,
yeah.
Sure. So two more things. One is, what else would you like listeners to know about Sea Otter coming up next week? And are there any virtual opportunities if somebody can't get there?
Well, let me take the second one first. We're focused on the physical event because it, you know, it's been 2.5 years. So down the road, we have talked about having some virtual opportunities, particularly with the expo. I think April would be the time to look at that kind of opportunity. But for people who are coming out next week, we get a lot of questions about what's going on in Monterey and California with COVID and Delta variant and so forth. The numbers in the state and particularly the numbers in Monterey County are very good. They're very low. As I mentioned previously, there have been a number of very large outdoor festival type events held in the Monterey Peninsula over the last couple of weeks. We do not have mask requirements. There's no checking of vaccination cards. Sea Otter, of course, will have a number of hand washing stations and, you know, encourage people to go ahead and social distance where they should. And, you know, just come on out. We're open and it's going to be healthy and it's going to be safe and it's going to be really the welcome back of a major cycling event in the United States.
It's time. It's time. I think there's a lot of pent-up demand. Well, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me. We've been speaking with Frank Yohannan. He is the director of Sea Otter Classic. Opens up next Friday, the 6th. Is that right?
Yes.
Yes. Friday, Saturday, Sunday in Monterey, California.
7th.
SeaOtterClassic.com. Thanks, Frank. Good luck. I wish I was there this year, but I was chicken. I decided not to fly yet, but maybe in April I'll see you out there.
Okay, Diane, thank you. And I will see you in April.
Okay, then. That's a date.
There we go. We made it.
We made a date. All right. Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Frank Yohannan is the director of the Sea Otter Classic. As he said, come on out to Monterey next weekend for a safe, fun, and exciting festival of cycling. You can learn more at SeaOtterClassic.com. Let's take a break, and when we come back, I'll introduce you to Professor Marlon Moncrief. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. The Outspoken Cyclist is proud to have BikeLaw as a trusted partner. If you find yourself in need of legal advice or assistance as it pertains to any cycling issue, log on to bikelaw.com. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. As a young boy in the UK, Marlon Moncrief rode his bicycle just like everyone else. At age 19, though, he started racing a bike and saw that most of the cyclists in the peloton did not look like him. Marlon is Black, and as a sociologist, he spent a lot of his adult years looking at the Black experience as it relates to cycling. Recently, his new book, Black Champions in Cycling, was published by Rafa and is the best-selling title in their portfolio. Marlon and I talk frankly about what it's going to take to see Black and Brown riders racing freely in the pro peloton, and especially in Europe. And as he asks, at what point does the talented Black cyclist find him or herself reaching the proverbial glass ceiling in racing? Hello, Marlon. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today. It is a pleasure to meet you.
Thanks, Diane. It's great to meet you all the way from the UK.
All the way from the UK. I'll tell you what, this technology has really changed the way our podcasting works. Because it used to be I would just, you know, get out my microphone and my soundboard. Now I actually get to see people with Zoom, and it seems to add a dimension. Even though I don't use the video necessarily, it adds a dimension to the conversation that I like. So my first word to you is wow. Just wow. You know, we've been talking about diversity and inclusion and equity, and your book, new book, got one right here, right? Black Champions in Cycling, Desire, Discrimination, Determination. It's just been, what do you have there? Is that the same thing?
It's the same thing. Yeah, I've got my
book. You know what? It showed up funny in the light, and I'm like, wow, it looks different. But it is. We have the same book. So I want to start with you, though, because I don't think, as a white person, even though we've been hearing everything since Black Lives Matters and all this other stuff, I still don't always get it. And I think reading your book, I got so much more than I've gotten before. So tell me about your background, starting as a youngster, and what it was like growing up and how you became who you are.
Yeah, well, Diane, you know, I actually didn't begin racing bikes until I was about 19 years old, 20 years old. Always used to ride a bicycle. I used to do a paper under my bicycle when I was a young boy. I used to ride my bicycle to school. I used to ride my bicycle to work. But no, my first race was a time trial up and down dual carriage races in the countryside here in the UK. I used to ride home and race this guy from work. And he asked me to come down to do these races. And in fact, I didn't really want to do these races because I wasn't really into that kind of cycling, but eventually I did go down. I gave it a go. And, you know, I come from a part of London where being Black in that part of London, we were very much a minority ethnic group. So I kind of socialised with white people and Black people. And so, you know, there wasn't any issues with me riding the bike as a Black person, as a youngster, at a young age. And I guess the way in which this book's come about has come about through my racing career, just sort of aiming to sort of put the pieces together, because I always saw Major Taylor and the images of Major Taylor as a cyclist, but I never really saw any Black British champions in the sport. So it was a case of looking out into the cycling universe to understand about the Black experience a bit more, as to why I hadn't seen Black riders represented in their countries from the UK or from the USA so much at the World Championships or at the Olympic Games. I just hadn't seen any. So this book's almost like comes from the back of that research and my own experiences of being a cyclist and loving the sport. Just wanted to find out more about the Black experience in that respect.
Going through the book and hearing the stories, because it's a series of stories.
Yeah.
I was both shocked and I was really kind of dismayed at the way Black cyclists were treated. It's like, you just can't imagine being this little white girl from Ohio being treated like this. I just don't understand it. And so reading these stories was like super enlightening. So when you look back over all of these seasons, and you take us through some really interesting history, and I want you to tell us about it.
Yeah.
You know, what do you think the percentage of Black riders actually is? Because there are Black riders, even though we aren't seeing them in the peloton on the world tour in big numbers. How many Black riders are racing their bicycles?
well, as professionals, you know, on the road for road racing, we don't really see many at the Grand Tours or at the Classics from the UK or the USA, do we? On the national scene, I know that in the USA, you know, we have the Legion of Los Angeles led by Justin Williams and Corey Williams, and of course, Rashaan Bharti before that with Methods for Winning and Sharon Smith. And on the national stage, there are quite a few known Black or African-American cyclists. In the UK, you know, not many at all. I mean, you know, the people that we can speak of over the last sort of 10, 20 years, Jermaine Burton is the son of Maurice Burton, and Maurice Burton was the original Black British champion from the 1970s. When I was racing my bicycle between 1994 and 2014 at elite level, you know, there was another person called David Clark who did pretty well, but not many. And there's not many coming through as well. I guess we have to look to France and the French Caribbean, to the likes of people like Johan Jean and or Kevin Racer of BB Hotels, or even to South Africa, to the likes of Nicolas Dlamini from Team Quebec. But yeah, so at the top end of the sport on the road, even as track cyclists, as track sprinters, there's a dearth of Black cyclists. At grassroots level, the USA has always had quite a strong scene of Black groups of cyclists. There's a history of that, and I kind of point to that in the book. In the UK, that scene of Black cycling groups has just emerged over the last sort of 5 years or so. So, yeah, it definitely was a phenomenon that I was interested in exploring through my research.
What do you think is keeping Black and brown riders from moving up in the ranks?
That is representation. You know, when I did this research that feeds into the book, the key question was, why aren't there any Black British cyclists representing Great Britain at the Olympics or at the World Championships? And as we go to the book, the same question is asked of riders from the USA, Black riders from the USA. And I think where it comes to access and inclusion in the sport, I think Great Britain, you know, the UK scene, from the evidence that I've got, there seems to be a good amount of welcome for Black cyclists in that respect. So I'll give some examples of someone called Clyde Rimple in the book, who came from the Caribbean and was welcomed by clubs back in the 1950s. And there's another example given by some club members. It's when the better Black cyclists engage with the national bodies that their potential's been stymied. And there's a pattern of that over the years. And looking and taking that comparison and looking at that across African-American cyclists in the USA, I guess the only, since Major Taylor, the only Black cyclist that seems to have sort of reached the heights and got fame was Nelson Vowles back in 84. But when you look at the stories of Justin Williams, of Rashaan Bharti, of Eric Saunders, of Tim Irwin, some of the guys that I've spoken with, it seems that, yeah, although there's been access to the sport and there's been a sense of inclusion by their clubmates, when it comes to engagement with the national bodies, there's always been a glass ceiling. And so they haven't been able to achieve that worldwide sort of recognition that may be the trigger to sort of bring more Black people into the sport. And that's been a pattern across both the USA and the UK. That you can actually see in the book through the stories.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce you. We're speaking with Dr. Marlon Lee Moncrief. His new book, Black Champions in Cycling, was published by RAFA. Thank you for doing that, RAFA. Desire, Discrimination, Determination. And boy, I'll tell you what, it takes a lot of that digging deep to do this. So I know Nelson Vowles. He and I have had long conversations, and he has tried, as have many other people, to bring more Black and brown riders into the sport. USA Cycling is doing an inclusion conference series. Do you think things are changing and will change? And I see Black and brown people as being innately athletic and certainly able to race at the same level as a Cadel Evans or whoever else is out there, right?
Yeah. I'm totally with you. I've always been fascinated. I used to watch a lot of track and field. I still do from time to time. And certainly when I was growing up, I used to watch it. And you know, the African-American sprinters, you know, the 4x100 meters relay, you know, it takes that kind of physique to be a track sprinter. I mean, there should be a conveyor belt of black sprinters, African-American sprinters coming out of the USA, but you just don't see them, do you? They're not coming through. Is it changing? Well, there's a possibility of change by the UCI World Cycling Center, I think particularly with the rise of the African cyclists from Eritrea, such as Nafnil Tesfasion. Biniam Girmay of Eritrea just won the silver medal at the World Road Race Championships in Flanders over the weekend. In the final chapter of my book, I do point to the African continent as to where the cycling revolution can occur in terms of showcasing, you know, the best riders on the world stage. Still, I mean, I go back to, you know, the hub of my interest has always been greater representation, seeing greater representation from the UK and across the USA as well. Yeah, I mean, I think the book does highlight the conspicuous absence of that. I think there is the possibility, but I think we need to sort of look to not just having the Cape Crusader on the bicycle inspiring younger people to come into the sport. We need African-American people, Black British people as leaders in the sport, sort of in terms of being commissaires, being even organisations, being administrators, being TV pundits as experts, educating the viewers as to what it takes to be a cyclist. You know, we need more people like Nelson Bowles and Justin Williams being seen in those roles of authority. That can really change the opinion about Black people being in the sport as well.
What do you think about the monetary barriers? Cycling is not a cheap sport. It's actually an annoying factor for me that I think it's really disturbing that, you know, you need to ride this outrageously expensive bike. But what do you think about that as a barrier, and how can people get over that perhaps?
It's such a difficult one to answer, isn't it? I've always called cycling the poor man's Formula One. You know, like in Formula One racing, when they're changing the car every year and you get new components to the car almost every race, that's the same for cycling. There's such an industry, and there's always going to be new components coming out every day, every week, every month, every year. And things change all the time. And, you know, you have to have quite a lot of money to do bicycle racing. It's not cheap to enter a bicycle race these days. And if you're from a lower socioeconomic background status, it's not going to be a sport that you're going to be looking to. Like, for example, if you want to get into soccer, into football over here, you just need a pair of football boots and a football and some friends to go and play with. I mean, the soccer scene in the UK, the football scene in the UK, if you're a young Black athletic person, you're more likely to want to go into football because, you know, if you see people being signed for £10 million to kick a football around and you know, you're probably more likely to go into that than in cycling, where you're not going to be getting that kind of money. So there's that attraction to doing different sports compared to cycling. I think this is a big discussion being had by the national body over here in terms of how we can attract more younger people into the sport, and, you know, and not to sort of be distracted from the cost of it. BMX has always been a useful way into the sport because the bikes aren't that expensive, and you can race each other on the park or on the field or in the woods. And then from that, perhaps if you have the talent, you may be able to sort of move into sort of track sprinting or road racing. But no, it's difficult. It's really difficult one to answer that one. So I haven't got the answers to it fully, but I think if there is some kind of cap on how young people race in terms of the equipment that they use, that might help. But I haven't got a full answer to that particular question. I'm sorry.
It's a tough one. It really is. Yeah. You know, I look at it even on the level of inner city kids here, regardless of the color of their skin, they also are somehow excluded from this elite sport. And yet I look at a sport like golf, and I always use golf because it's a sport I happen to like, even though I don't play it. And golf comes back to the community with programs for inner city kids, for programs for anybody who wants to pick up a club and hit a ball. And yet cycling doesn't seem to do that. I know that's what USA Cycling says it wants to do, but whether it's actually going to do it is going to be an interesting thing going forward.
It's a really interesting analogy you pick up there. I was thinking about golf just before coming on to speak to you, because Tiger Woods, when Tiger Woods burst onto the scene, I think it was in 1997 that he won the Masters, and that's nearly 25 years ago, isn't it? So there's a black athlete walking into a dominant white sport and becoming this huge superstar, but we haven't seen a conveyor belt of Tiger Woods come through. It's still quite an elitist sport in the USA. There's not been, you know, there's no sort of black versions of Tiger Woods in Great Britain. So there's not been much change there. And it's still quite an expensive sport to get into with golf. You know, you've got to pay green fees. You've got to travel around. You know, cycling's a bit like golf, I guess, but cycling's, for me personally, and you probably get this from a lot of the cycling benefits, it's very much a lifestyle. You live the sport. You have to be a mechanic. You have to make sacrifices. You've got to look after your body. You've got to eat a certain way. You've got to go and ride that in the rain, in the cold. And as I said, against sports like football, where you're getting, you know, thousands and thousands of pounds for kicking a football around, if you're a young back athlete, that might be a greater attraction than doing cycling, where you're going to get, you know, you're going to get much attention. So it's very exclusive. You have to really love it, and you have to really love the culture of the sport. And, you know, with a lot of the black cyclists that I've worked with, as part of this book, and that's the same for some of the American and the USA cyclists as well, there's been a lot of sanction for them to enter the sport through white coaches, through white mentors, through white clubs. So some of them have been assisted along the way. It's not deeply embedded into the culture of the black community as it is with the white community. And I think if we do produce some black superstars in the future, and there's a greater level of acceptance, then maybe things could change there.
Well, you just brought up the next thing I want to talk about, and that is acceptance and discrimination and the kinds of treatment that black and brown cyclists seem to receive in the peloton once they get there. I don't understand why it isn't more of a gentleman's sport. Forgetting the women for a moment, I would think that, I don't know, I think the women maybe are treated a little better, but the men are not. And I don't understand, first of all, how you put up with it, you know, and like not deck somebody.
Yeah.
But, and I mean, some of the things that I read in the book are like, okay, I can't believe somebody would say that to you. Why would somebody say such a thing? How do you put up with that?
It's unacceptable, isn't it? It's just totally unacceptable. But I think it's just, you know, it's that sense of power and ownership, and seeing the black body entering into that white space has been an intrusion. I mean, you know, you trace that from the experience of Major Taylor. I begin the book by sort of giving some examples of Major Taylor's treatment that he had to put up with when he raced around certain parts of Jim Crow USA and even across Europe, the physical violence that he suffered, and to some extent the past is in the present with some of the professional cyclists that I speak of in the book over the last 50 years, you know, from Maurice Burton's treatment when he went to race over in Europe, to some of the more recent black African cyclists in the peloton in Europe, the way in which they've been marginalized and treated as out of place in the peloton. It continues. I just really wanted to show the readership that if you are a black man aiming to get into the sport, this is what you have to deal with, but you shouldn't have to deal with this. And hopefully people from the UCI are seeing this evidence, and they're going to be putting something in place. There's some sanctions in place to ban cyclists from the sport if they do treat their fellow colleagues like this, because, if you know, in effect, this is the workplace. Now if I were at the workplace and I had my colleagues being violent to me through racism, I'd be reporting them straight away, and I'd expect those colleagues would be given a sack or or being asked to, or being removed from their work. So hopefully people from the UCR will be seeing this evidence and will be able to put things in place to protect Black cyclists in the future.
Yeah, I think we need to see Black cyclists on the UCI boards. You know, they need to be at those levels too, not just, you know, moving into the sport. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk with Marlon Moncrief some more. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. I'm speaking with Professor Marlon Moncrief about his new book, Black Champions in Cycling. So that's one of the changes. What else could we change to show that the sport is more open to everybody who wants to race a bicycle?
Well, I mean, there's quite a lot of talk going on, not just in the USA. I've seen some of the programs that you were talking about, some of the discussions that you were talking about from USAC, We Champion Inclusion, and there's lots of discussions happening over here via British Cycling. Change can't be forced, though. It can't be forced upon people. There needs to be an attraction to the sport in order to sort of bring more black interest into the sport, but also to allow for the dominance of white people in the sport to accept where black people, brown people, Asian people come into the sport. It's for the good of the sport to advance the sport and not to feel threatened by that. That's what I see. So yeah, I guess like what I said earlier, but change doesn't always have to come from the hero or the heroine racing the bicycle, but we need to allow more black cyclists who've been there, seen her and done it, to sort of take on positions of as TV experts, speaking to the sport, speaking to the audience through their expertise and knowledge. I think that's quite important. I think in that position of authority, that's going to sort of give people the sense that that it's not just a white person who can speak with authority on the sport. I think that needs to occur. You mentioned people going onto the UCI. Well, why not have more sort of black people taking the lead at national level? I know that there was a change after the Black Lives Matter protest with USA Cycling bringing more people of colour onto their board. It hasn't happened in the UK with British Cycling. All of the board is still white people, so that doesn't foster too much trust with the emergent black groups that are coming through. So I think there needs to be a shift in that respect, in spreading responsibility and power and direction, so that it can be seen as a sport for all.
Yes, a sport for all. It is a sport for all. You know, it's one of those. I mean, everybody can ride a bike. Well, not everybody, but 98% of the population can ride a bike and starts out riding a bike, and suddenly something else draws them away. But for those people who really want to ride a bike, I think that that opportunity needs to stay there.
Do you know what, John? I just want to say one thing. It's a bit like when we see cycling on television, we're seeing a show. We're watching a show and we're seeing the actors on this particular stage, aren't we? It's a bit like watching a Hollywood movie. But I guess it's still like watching a Hollywood movie back in the 1930s, where all of the actors are white actors on that big stage. So when we watch the Tour de France, when we watch the classics, when we watch the Giro, when we watch the Vuelta, we always see the white actors like we always used to see the white actors back in Hollywood back in the 1920s and 30s. So what's happened today with the film industry, with Hollywood, you know, with Netflix, is that we're seeing a broader variety of actors on the stage, aren't we? Because there's been change there. And that change, that's a similar change that we need to see with cycling. So I guess with the emergent forces, you know, that we're seeing in Eastern Africa through the Eritrean riders that I've spoken about, if we get to see those guys racing at the Tour de France, at the Vuelta, at the Classics, and winning those races, and, you know, doing well in the mountains and getting onto the podium, then that would be an example of showing that cycling is a sport for all, just like the movies now can be seen as movies for all. So we're definitely not there yet. That's a kind of comparison that we can use to understand how far cycling has to come.
And I guess it is on the move. I mean, that was a good analogy for me. The idea that there are so many more television and movie opportunities for all kinds of people, and people yeah. are less, and even in advertising, it's less likely that it stays white only, because black and brown people are now speaking up, number one, and saying, I want my place and I deserve my place, and which, of course, they always have. It's changing so slowly, it seems. But now there seems to be some acceleration.
I think it's, you know, we exist in a particularly sort of Western narrative, a Eurocentric narrative in all forms in life, you know, whether that be via the economy, in education, in sport, in arts. These are all Eurocentric constructs, aren't they? They're not, you know, and they've, you know, these are all sort of Eurocentric Western white ideas, white visions. And I'm not going to speak too academically, but I'm going to speak from a sociological kind of perspective here. You know, with the diaspora, the 400-year diaspora from Africa, you know, and the legacies of that generation after generation, the people from that diaspora are asking to be included into that narrative, included into that particular vision. In some fields, they've broken into that, and they you know they've broken into that, and in some fields they may be leading in that particular narrative. In some fields they may have caught up. We've just given you an example of that via film and the movies, where, you know, even in music as well. But in cycling, black people are still knocking on that particular door to be included and to be seen as equal. And yeah, so that's where we are with this particular sport. I guess with tennis, you know, we've had the Williams sisters, we've had Naomi Osaka come through. We haven't seen it with men's tennis so much. We haven't seen anyone since Arthur Ashe, have we?
No, you're right.
Exactly. So there's still some way to go with some particular elements. And yeah, so it's all about that particular world narrative, that particular reality that we're born into as human beings. It's either aiming to sort of change the story to do something completely different, which most people don't want to because they want to stick with the norms. And if people want to stick with the norms, then it's about aiming to sort of break down this particular narrative that we've inherited. So that's where we are with cycling, with the Tour de France, with the Vuelta, with the Giro. They're seen as the narratives that we have to sort of live by, rather than aiming to create something new. There is a tour of Rwanda. Why can't that be seen as a grand tour that all countries go to and see as equal to the Tour de France? It's not, is it? It's not. It's seen as inferior to the Tour de France. But why not raise that particular tour up to an equal status? So there's still a long way to go in terms of superiority and inferiority in terms of people.
Well, it's interesting you bring up a tour of Rwanda. You know, the U.S. stage races have come and gone. And so it looks like everything is still Eurocentric. And so that's where the focus has been and probably will be for some time. And there is just no reason that we can't see all the faces in the peloton. I just see riders are going to start coming up and doing better. And these teams, I have to blame some of it on teams and sponsorship and, you know, director sportif not bringing in the talent that's already there.
I think with the Tour de France, it has been tried. I mean, Douglas Ryder and Team Quebec have aimed to showcase some riders from South Africa. I mean, Nicolas Dlamini is an example of a black rider that rode in the Tour de France, but that was just one rider out of an entire peloton of white riders. And in effect, he replaced Kevin Racer, who was a black rider from last year. So it was almost like blackface, sort of replacing blackface. I mean, with the Tour de Rwanda, we've got to remember that that particular country is a former French colony. And so there's going to be some French influence into that particular tour. The last tour of Rwanda, the team that won it was a French team, you know, was a white French winner of that particular tour in Rwanda. The UCI have just announced that the World Championships in 2025 will go to Rwanda, which there are some pros and cons in that, because, of course, it's going to a black, you know, an African country where it's going to be a black audience, which may sort of help to raise the profile of the sport for black people in terms of black participation and a black audience. But at the same time, it may be crowning white European kings and queens of the sport, which is dangerous as well. And that's just going to be, that's just going to reinforce colonialism, isn't it, in that respect? So there are so many pros and cons with the World Championships in its construct going there. So I think where we will see real change in a sport for being shown as a sport for all in terms of equality is when we see, just like we saw in the Tour of Rwanda, where we had that white French team winning the Tour of Rwanda. If we see an African team, a black African team winning the Tour de France or winning the Giro or winning the Vuelta, and, you know, and dominating in the mountains, that's when we can say, yes, you know, this is a sport for, just like we've seen Will Smith being the star role of films in Hollywood, or, you know what I mean? That is when we can say that things have changed for real, and the movies are for all. We can have black actors starring just as we can have white actors starring. That's where we can say that cycling's really changed at the top. So there's still a long way to go.
I think we'll get there.
I think we're close, you know. I think all it really
even
takes
better.
It takes money. One billionaire could change the story straight away if they invested in, you know, a team in Africa that's got a lot of potential. They said, right, we're going to invest in this team. The next 10 years, we're going to put millions into this team. We're going to take them to the Tour de France, and we're going to win with this team to change the narrative completely. And we're going to sustain this as well, not just for that team to be a team of outliers, but for this team to set a legacy, to set a conveyor belt of competitive Africans against competitive Europeans, competitive white cyclists, to advance the sport, to show that it's a sport for all, to show inclusion in that particular narrative. That's what it takes, really. But it's a case of whether somebody really wants to do that.
Well, let's hope they do. We've been speaking with Dr. Marlon Moncrief. His new book, Desire, Discrimination, Determination, Black Champions in Cycling. It's a great book. I assume you can get it at all of the usual places. It was published by Rafa.
Yeah. The History of Black Cyclists in 3D. That's what I call it, in 3D. Look, it's basically, it's a Rafa editions book. It's been produced by Rafa via Blue Train Publishing. The editor was Guy Andrews, and the photograph editor was Taz Darling. And they've produced some really fantastic books. And yeah, it can be bought via the Rafa website. And it's available across the USA Rafa branches, and available across all of the Rafa branches in Asia, in Australia, and across Europe as well. So hopefully, I mean, the book's Rafa's fastest selling book ever at the moment. And so, you know, a fantastic team behind this, but not just me with my name on the front cover of the book and with the work that I put in, but the cyclists themselves have contributed some of their personal photographs, they've contributed their stories. I've reached out to lots of professional photographers over the years who've helped me with their archives to sort of populate the book with some really fantastic photographs. So it's an all-round team effort, this book. It really is. So, yeah, I'm really happy with what we've done.
It's a wonderful book, and I think it belongs on every cyclist's bookshelf, and it will be proudly on mine. And I enjoyed reading it. The stories they're great stories, but boy, I'll tell you what, they cut deep. You know, they are not what I had hoped to read, and yet I think they're very enlightening. I think that people will get a sense of how our sport has been going down the wrong path for a very long time, and maybe bringing it to light will begin to change the way we think.
You know, this is the first, I don't use like using that term, but the most, you know, the last black race and cyclist to write a book about cycling was Maddie Taylor. There's been no black cyclist, not even Nelson Vales from the USA has written a book about cycling. So this book brings, it aims to bridge that gap, but it includes the raw stories from as many cyclists that have been in the sport from the USA, from the UK, from across Africa to sort of share their stories. So hopefully this can start a brand new genre of books from the black perspective that can be blended with the normal sort of cycling books that we get in order to know more about the sport. There's so much in the cycling universe for us to understand. So hopefully this book can be a useful contribution to that knowledge.
Well, I appreciate you writing it, and I appreciate you taking time to talk with me today. I really enjoyed our conversation. I hope we get to talk again.
It's been a pleasure, Diane. Thank you very much.
Thank you. My thanks to Marlon for speaking with me today, and especially for writing this book. I think it's worth the read for all of us to not only see the history of what's really been happening, but to better understand and be part of the change that is hopefully finally coming to our sport. You can get your copy of Black Champions in Cycling at rafa.cc from any of their stores listed on the site or from all the usual online book places. So let's take another short break, and when we come back, we'll hear what USA Cycling is saying about inclusion, diversity, and equity in our sport with their new inclusion conferences. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. We talk with Rob DeMartini at USA Cycling occasionally, and in our last conversation, USAC was preparing for an in-person inclusion conference that would be hosted by USAC, but run by Ashlyn Johnson, founder of the Inclusion Playbook. Of course, as with many events over the past year, USAC decided it would be prudent to pivot to an online presentation, and from there, break the conference up into a once-a-month, two-hour series to which anyone and everyone is invited. Here's my conversation with Rob about the conference and what he hopes will come out of it. Hi, Rob. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Last time we spoke, there was a lot going on. Now there's a lot going on. Talk to me. What's going on?
Well, there is a lot going on. We got back from Tokyo and immediately had four additional world championships, and I had not been through that cycle before and didn't realize there was no breather allowed. And we're getting ready for Road Worlds next week in Belgium, and we have a crew of, between athletes, staff, and support, about 70 people over there. So should be a good world.
Yeah, it sounds like baptism by fire for you.
It does. I should have thought it through, but for some reason, I thought they were going to give us a breather when we got back from Tokyo.
Let's talk about something we started talking about the last time you and I spoke, and that is this inclusion conference. And the first piece of it was this past week, and you had a pivot from, we were going to come in person. I was going to fly out to Colorado. Well, that didn't happen. So what did happen? And let's start with the first piece, because there's a lot more to come.
Yep. The Friday before the holiday weekend, we were looking at data for El Paso County and talking to folks, and figured that doing this in person, as much as we wanted it to be a two-day in-person event, we had about 100 people registered, not counting our staff. We decided that we had to take it virtual because the COVID numbers in El Paso County just didn't look good, and we didn't want to create a well-intentioned super spreader event. So we made the call on Friday. We quickly talked to sponsors and speakers and attendees and decided that, a two-day video conference or Zoom conference, that's just unacceptable. Nobody can pay attention that long. So we broke it up into kind of logical sections, just like the agenda was going to be, but spread them out. We had the first one last Friday, and then they are one Thursday a month, currently scheduled through October, November, and December. and then we'll schedule more of them afterward. We did make the commitment that it is our intention that the end of the series, if you will, would be in person if COVID allows us, because we do think that there's some, you know, there's definitely value in the conversations that happen between the presentations, maybe even more so. But we had our first session last Friday. It was a little bit more of a one-way communication than the rest of them will be, because we had to set the stage. Ashlyn Johnson and her team from the Inclusion Playbook laid out the plan, and she's been working with us for more than a couple of years now on this subject for about 10 months or 8 months. And then David Lipscomb, who's an OD resource out of the corporate world, who has spent a number of the recent years as a cycling coach, is a bike racer, is a member of USAC, and has been a advisor to Kelsey Erickson and the Diversity Inclusion Task Force that we've been running since February. So those two spoke. I thought it was great. We had about just under 100, I think, attendees, not counting USAC staff. And I hope it started what will be an important conversation going forward.
I have to admit, I did see it. So I was privy to the recording. So I saw, and I didn't watch every minute of it, but it was very interesting. I don't know who was there. So who, besides David and Ashlyn and Kelsey and you, all four of you were yep. clearly on the screen. Who were the attendees, and from kind of what diversified fields are they representing?
I would put them in three groupings as we think about it, and Kelsey can get you the actual attendee list. But like I said, we had about 100. They would fall into either bike or component or supply suppliers. The second group would have been panelists that were scheduled to speak on a subject, and I can cover what the subjects to come would be. And then the third group, I would call them in, you know, members of USAC who are interested in the subject, and or non-members. I mean, this is not closed to members only, so you don't need to be a member to USAC to attend this. But people who have a vested interest in seeing the sport, and specifically seeing us, USA Cycling, get better at bringing diversity into the cycling community. You know, we focused it on four groups: women, the LGBTQIA organization community, athletes with disabilities, and underrepresented minorities. And, you know, there are other places we'll go in the future, but from the beginning, it was set up to try to speak to, and in some cases, for and by representatives of those communities. USA Cycling has, I hope you noticed this in the first session, we've got very little control of the agenda or the content. We are customers of the content, not delivering it. And I don't think we're in a place to deliver it. So Kelsey and I tried to set that up front. We've been trying to say that in the press releases throughout the beginning. We're not telling the industry what needs to be done. We're asking some hard questions and then listening to the answers from those who have lived you know, these underrepresented groups in cycling. And in Ashlyn's case, you know, her experience goes way beyond cycling. And
right.
She's incredibly talented. She is she's an attorney. She's a collegiate Division I athlete. And she's been working in kind of the social equity and justice space for more than a decade, and does work for the NFL, the NBA. I mean, we feel lucky to be one of her clients.
Let me remind listeners, we're speaking with Rob DeMartini. He's the president of USA Cycling, USAC. And we're talking about this inclusion conference series. Now it's a series, one Thursday a month through December, and then we'll see what happens come the new year. And the first of the series was this past week. And I did hear your opening remarks and felt that they were really interesting. I know that, and you've said this before, that you come from a place where you're not sure you're able to really get what the other side looks like. You know, what is it that keeps people from feeling included in the bicycle world? And it's probably not just bicycle. It's probably tennis. It's probably a lot of sports. But our interests, of course, are in cycling. So I guess when we talk about inclusion, it always comes up for me that some of the barriers have to do with money, and they also have to do with rolling up to a line and not seeing people who look like you.
Yeah.
How are you tackling those kinds of questions? They're just so, it seems so vast.
Well, I think I agree with everything you said. I mean, I don't feel like, I think what I've learned this year, and I referenced in my opening comments, you know, when I was at New Balance, I went through a situation, the company went through a situation when the previous administration was elected that got us sideways. I'll say unintentionally, but it doesn't matter. We were sideways with our consumer base, and we did a lot of work, and I honestly thought I got it. And, you know, I'm a white male who's had a very traditional and kind of privileged access to things. But I thought I kind of got this and was at a minimum, and I know this is true, was empathetic to the situation of being underrepresented. But, you know, after the difficulty I went through kind of on in the Twitter sphere this year and making some remarks that were clearly not very sensitive and that I own completely, you know, I kind of had to ask myself, maybe I don't get it. I mean, conceptually getting it is one thing, but feeling that experience. And I thought Kelsey did a very good job, and I'm not going to get her words right, but the intention was there's a difference between being invited and being welcome. And I think our sport, you know, we can officially invite anybody and we can hold up individual examples of different types of underrepresented communities in our membership and say, see, look, it works. Well, it's not that easy. There's a huge difference than of feeling, you know, I'll tell you, you know, I think everybody experiences this, but just to different levels. And I think the underrepresented groups experience it every day, everywhere they turn. And that's what potentially me is not as just attuned to. And the commitment I made is, you know, I'm going to try to work on myself and my organization to get better at this. I can't change the experiences I've had in the past or not had, and I can't change the opportunities I've had or not had. But what I can do is significantly elevate my awareness and listening to those who live this every day. And I thought her comments about, you know, we want to move beyond invited to welcome. And I think the sport's got a long way to go there.
That's USA Cycling's position. And I'm going to name that Rob says this, therefore it's the position of USA Cycling. Just as a contrast to what I'm going to say next, which is this conference is being supported by a lot of the big players in our business. People like Trek, people like SRAM. People for bikes.
Yep.
I'm not sure I see their commitment in the same way. And I only say that I'm not as much of an outsider just because I'm a journalist. I'm an insider because I'm also part of the bicycle business. And as I see prices going up and as I see components becoming more expensive and as I see entry fees getting higher and higher, I'm wondering how we're going to do this. How are we going to make people feel welcome who can't even look at a $10,000 bike and say, I will never be able to afford that?
First of all, I'll start with this. I don't have that answer.
I know.
But what I do think, though, and in fairness, you know, we had seven companies step up and offer to help us with this financially. I very much appreciate that. I know their intentions are excellent. You know, and the quality of their own influence in the space they control, I don't feel I'm in a good place to comment on it. You know, I certainly having run a company before, I know you got your own plans and they need to fit within everything else you do. I do know that Trek, that Canyon, that Victoria, that Zwift, that Strava, SRAM, Gooder Sunglasses, Allied PsychWorks, they all came to us offering to help. And while any one of those efforts by itself is probably not sufficient, it's a good place to start. And some of the work I've seen other groups that aren't in that collection of people that chose to help us, you know, the work that Rafa's doing right now is excellent. And so I think it's steps at a time. I was going to say small steps, but I think that will anger the people that are, you know, think they've been patient long enough and they don't want to be patient anymore. But we got to take steps and we've got to work together. And I think USA Cycling is actually pretty well positioned to facilitate this. You know, along with Jen Dice and the People for Bikes, we sit in the middle and we want to see all things grow, whether it's our own businesses or whether it's just cycling in general. So we win either way. And I think we just got to work at it. And I thought Friday was a good start on our part and we got a long way to go.
What was your biggest takeaway from your first session?
I think you just touched on it, just how hard this is. How hard to make lasting change or to help push along lasting change. And, you know, the degrees of disenfranchisement from the sport, there's a lot of them. And some of them are really, really kind of aggressively out there. I don't mean that negatively. I just mean a long way away from what the sport is today. And I know we can't satisfy everybody. And I know some people question our intent. I know that the work that's gone into it by the folks at USA Cycling is well-intentioned and hopefully will be effective and measure us by what we get done, not what I talk about.
Yeah, I'm seeing some changes visually. I'm actually seeing some changes come up on social media. You and I have talked extensively about how important it is that everybody become a member so that they're part of the conversation. Mm-hmm. So how can people become part of this conversation with USA Cycling, with the David Lipscombs, with the Ashlands, and with Kelsey?
Well, the first thing is just, I want to be crystal clear on this. You do not need to be a member to come to any of these virtual. They're 2 hours. They're on Thursday. You know, I'd ask anybody to clip in for a half hour. And if we don't keep your interest, then move on. But don't sit on the outside wishing and hoping for change. Come in and be part of the path forward. And that's the easiest way, is just listen in. And the first one, if you watch it recorded, it's a little bit one way. We didn't get a whole lot of audience feedback just because of the nature of the way we broke it up. Just like if we had been in person, the first 2 hours would not have been, you know, back and forth. The rest of the next 2 days would have been. And so I think I pulled the dates up. Thursday, let me just find it real quick. You know, the next one is Thursday, October 7th. The topics are unpacking race, gender, and socioeconomic status. And I will tell you that Ashland has worked very hard to get these. Some of them are speakers, some of them are panels, some of them are Q&As, to make them both insightful, from the voice of experience, and engaging and collaborative. So we'll see if we live up to that. But I'd ask everybody to come and listen to it. It's distributed online. You know, you can tie into the Zoom link and just watch and contribute as you see fit.
What we'll do is we'll post that. We'll let people go to USA Cycling and try to and log on. So the next one's October 7th. That's not too far from now. And then there's one in November and one in December. Did Ashland or Kelsey or anybody yet come up with an end goal, something you'd like to see happen out of these conferences?
Let me answer it this way, that we've talked about that at length. We honestly think that the goal should come out of the work itself. I'll say in a COVID allowing way, we would come together towards the end of this conference and actually write an action plan and put that in place. You know, that's the path we're on right now. And, you know, again, depending on what the world allows us to do in person, that's the current plan. So we have some ideas. We did not feel it was appropriate for us to unilaterally articulate the goals. I mean, the broad goals are a sport that's available to everybody, that people feel welcome in and reflects the diversity of this country. I said that 2 years ago, that that's what we wanted our membership to look like. We just got a long way to go. But the specific actions will come out of the end of the, I think it's set up to be 6 sessions in total if it goes virtual the whole way.
Yeah, it'd be nice to start getting back together, but I like that at least it's still happening.
Well, and I will say this, that, you know, originally Kelsey and I were super bummed because she put in a massive amount of work and this was going to be a good conference. While the event might have been a bit more fun in the other format, I do think actually the outcomes might be better here because there is some warming up and trust that needs to be built by everybody. And by doing it over time, you know, by the time we do come together, it won't be initial meetings. At least I've watched this with our DEI task force. They're much more engaging and demanding today than they were the first day, simply because there was actually zero trust at all. And I'm not complaining about it. I'm just acknowledging that's where that was. Our intents were not understood. And I think over time, I don't think we've won people over on all the work we're doing or not doing, but I do think there's an inherent degree of trust among Kelsey and her task force.
Interesting observation. I mean, it certainly makes sense that as you spend more time with people, whether it's online or personally, to break it up the way you're breaking it up, you have some time in between the sessions to actually digest and come up with whatever it is the next thing you want to contribute, if you're going to be a contributor to the sessions. And yeah. So that is my last question. Will people be allowed to contribute their thoughts and their ideas ongoingly throughout the conference?
I mean, absolutely, yes. In fact, it'll be a failure if people feel like they can't. We tried to set the stage that both, you know, through chat vehicles, through some sort of the upcoming sessions, and I don't exactly know which one, but the upcoming sessions have survey work built into them. So there will be a place for people to provide their input and challenge if they're not hearing what they think they should be hearing, as well as access both to me and to Kelsey privately 24/7. So I hope so.
So they'll be able to log on to usacycling.org and find these links.
Yes, this is it there. And there's also a private, and I'm going to get the name wrong. I can get it from Kelsey and get it to you. There's an inbox just for inclusion conference, follow-up questions, that type of thing. I'll get that today and send it to you. Go ahead. It's anonymous. She gathers it and we just share the feedback. We don't attribute it to anybody.
Okay. And I have the link to the first session that I just saw that you guys just did. And I will post these. You just emailed me or sort of chatted with me about what's coming up next. And yes, I saw this on the agenda. So I just think that for the people who don't want to just pay lip service to the idea of diversity and inclusion and equity, this is a big step forward. I for one, am very pleased to see it. And I appreciate that USA Cycling is the one stepping up to do it.
If we do it right, it'll be a community effort of people in the bike industry and not just us. It hasn't been that so far. And as I said before, we don't have the expertise to teach on this subject by any stretch. And that's not lost on me or anybody on our team. We're listening and we're trying to do it with a very kind of open ears and open heart and then say, all right, with that learning, what do we go do with it? I think some good ideas are starting to bubble up on things we can try to do to have an impact.
Well, as always, it's a pleasure to talk with you and to hear what's going on. You have put your money where your mouth is, continually saying the things and following up with them more so than anybody I've ever met at USA Cycling. So I appreciate all the hard work you're putting into it.
Well, it's really the work of the staff, and Kelsey's on point on this, but David's been helpful. The DEI task force has been very helpful, and we wouldn't be where we are without their efforts.
And we thank them all. All right. We will talk again soon. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Diane. Good to see you.
You too. Rob DeMartini is the president of USAC. If you are interested in watching and or listening to the first session of the Inclusion Conference, you can find it at usacycling.org. Go to the Safe, Sport, and Well-Being tab at the top and scroll down to the Inclusion Conference link. And you can register and attend all of these conferences there, too. So my thanks to Frank Yohannan, Marlon Moncrief, and Rob DeMartini for joining me today. My thanks to you for listening. Remember that you can always go to our website, OutspokenCyclist.com, and see every episode listed with links, show notes, and photos. You can also go to our Facebook page and join any of the conversations that are going on all the time. I'll be back next week with a brand new episode of The Outspoken Cyclist. But meantime, please stay safe, stay well, and remember, there is always time for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We welcome your thoughts and contributions on our Facebook page, or visit OutspokenCyclist.com to leave a comment on any episode. We will be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast app and you'll never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.